Are you one of the few people left on the planet who hasn't yet watched the Kony 2012 video? Yeah. It's because you're scared of crying, aren't you? It really is a very powerful, amazing viral phenomenon, Kony 2012. This video, which is now on YouTube, I looked at it just before I came, and it's over 75 million views on YouTube, and I suspect maybe, you know, two-thirds of that on Vimeo on top of that. And it's just like that noise all across the world, this powerful video. It's a real phenomenon, and it is it's telling the story of Joseph Kony, a Ugandan military leader who has been a real, well, it's a filthy piece of work, who has stolen children to work as sex slaves and child soldiers as he has perpetuated his cause and his group within this troubled nation. And it's trying to make us aware of the things he does, the things he has done, the impact it has on ordinary people, ordinary children. And it's an amazing, amazing video. Amazing because it does draw you in very powerfully and expose you very brutally to the reality of these things. They're in our world. The world we live in is a horrible world where people do horrible things. One quote from a minister in Sydney said that we ought to show this video to young people. Even though it is graphic and alarming, it is good for the bubble-wrapped generation to see that the world is still full of evil. Helping kids see that there is more to the world than Westfields and iPhones is an important message for them. It's shocking, it's offensive, and it's terrific that in the world of so much froth and bubble on the internet, that there is something like that that really gets you thinking. It's a brilliant viral strategy. The video is amazingly made. It's just good art. It plays off between the black faces of children in Uganda we may not relate to, but then the white face of an American child that we can relate to, and then forces us as the white, rich Westerner, forces you to then go, oh my goodness, these are like real people, like my little cousin, like my little brother. And it's good because it has this vision of wanting to make the perpetrators of horrendous crime that we are unaware of in the West, to make them as famous as George Clooney is. That they use the vehicles of social media and celebrity not simply to celebrate the ab workouts of some famous celebrity or their latest sort of romantic foray or what shoes the princess is wearing this week, but to also use that to name and shame evil ones and make them household names, to disgrace them before the world and to arouse in us outrage. It's terrific. But it's not that simple. And as I watched the video, I watched a few days before the gush on Facebook, and when I finally got around to watching the video, I must admit I was as horrified as I was kind of irritated as well. I don't know if those of you who've watched it have felt that as well. That it was hard to know, was the video mainly about Joseph Kony and his atrocities, or was it mainly about how amazingly empowered you can be, guys, if you buy a bracelet, share a video, and stick up some posters? Was it really about stopping the man, or was it about celebrating the campaign idea? There was a vanity, I fear, built into it, and a vanity that taps right into the generation you're in, a generation which says, you be empowered, you are everything, you make the choice, you can do it. You can be everything. All you need to do is click like, and you're changing the world. And so there's something very exciting about us that when we get told, even the greatest evils of the world, you can do it. Wear a bracelet. You can do it. Buy the right coffee. You can do it. And the great thing is all you need to do is do what you're doing anyway, which is consume and buy. And so you can, by your consumerism and materialism, make a difference in the world while remaining materialistic and consumeristic. There's that danger there, which is worth just seeing. And there's built into it maybe a naivety that it's not as if it was only when Facebook was invented and when this video was published that people realised there were horrors in the world. There have been people working intelligently, thoroughly, with phenomenal discipline for decades and centuries and millennia to deal with evil in the world. and have come up against barriers and frustrations. And you know what? A social networking site is not going to suddenly change all that. There have been people who are addressing these evils all the time, and the evils are complex, the evils are deep-rooted, and even if we did find Kony, who the video says in passing is no longer actually super, super active in Uganda anyway, even if we did find him and did stop him doing whatever evil he still remains to do, we've just stopped a guy who is not at his prime. We haven't stamped out child slavery. We haven't stamped out paramilitary groups. We haven't saved Uganda from instability. Besides, the video urges us to support the US supporting the Ugandan army, and the Ugandan army is no Tea Party either, but commits its own atrocities. In the complex film Syriana, one of the dialogues observed, you just need to decide when you're going to stop digging. Because if you keep on digging, you're going to find more bodies, you're going to find more problems, you're going to find more corruption. It's good to want to stop injustice. It's good to do something. And if this video does something and brings to mind something of an outrage, it's terrific. But man, this world is ruined. And it's going to take a lot more than a viral video or even stopping Joseph Kony to solve the problems of this world. Which brings us then to this whole question of charity. If it's so complex, why bother? One of the last great waves of sort of social conscience was in the early 1980s when Bob Geldof from the Boomtown Rats started the Live Aid concerts. Maybe you've heard of those great Live Aid concerts in the early 80s where U2 and the Police and Queen and all these kind of so daggy now they're kind of cool again in an ironic way kind of bands performed these enormous charity concerts to raise and bring to attention the starvation happening in Africa during the affluence of the First World in the 80s, and trying to arouse people to compassion and to charity. And yet what historians charted about the Live Aid concerts was it got to a point by the mid-1980s where it was almost as if the celebrity community and just the general community hit kind of a point of charity fatigue, that there were suddenly so many bloated bodies and exposed ribs, only so many statistics and appeals, and yet it would continue. We get to a point where we get numb, we get fatigued, we just can't feel anymore, we can't care anymore. And that the very guilt of feeling that way becomes even more exhausting. And so it will happen with your generation, that the great drive, that honourable drive for social justice, will hit a point of fatigue, and then becomes the challenge. Will we continue to do good beyond the point where it's sexy and exciting to do good? Will we do good even when there's not an awesome soundtrack behind the video of the people who are doing good? The parable of the Good Samaritan is a terrific one, as it draws attention to this great teaching of Jesus that the life of true spirituality, the authentic Christian, is one who cares for the poor. We could look at many passages in the New Testament that teach this. The Sermon on the Mount, blessed are the poor, they will be filled. God has a heart for the poor. We've got the parable of the sheep and the goats, where the ones who are welcomed into eternal dwellings are those who visited those who were in prison, who fed those who were hungry. We could look at James chapter 2. Let's come to James 2, because it is a winner. Keep your hand in Luke, and we'll just come to James chapter 2, which challenges us to demonstrate faith in the God who is there, and faith in the gospel, by our attitude to those who are in need. James chapter 2. James is right towards the end of the Bible, before Revelation. Get to Revelation, you're too far. If you get to Hebrews, you haven't gone far enough. James chapter 2. My brothers, and he's talking to Christians and saying, my brothers and sisters, as believers in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ, don't show favoritism. Suppose a man comes into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. If you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, here's a good seat for you, but say to this poor man, you sit here. Stand there on the floor by my feet. Have you not discriminated among yourselves and become judges with evil thoughts? Listen, my dear brothers. Hasn't God chosen those who are poor in the eyes of the world to be rich in faith and to inherit the kingdom he promised to those who love him? But you've insulted the poor. Isn't it the rich who are exploiting you? Are not they the ones who are dragging you into court? Are they not the ones slandering the noble name of to him to whom you belong? Or down in verse 14, what good is it, my brothers, verse 14, if a man claims to have faith I believe in Jesus, but has no deeds. Can such a faith save him? Suppose a brother or sister is without clothes or daily food. If one of you says to him, good on you, like you, I wish you well, off you go, be warm and well fed, and there she goes. But if we do nothing to help them, what good is that? I really think we should do something to help people who are poor. All in favour? Aye. Well, the ayes have it. We all really think we should do something for the poor. It's no good. And in the same way, a faith that is not accompanied by action is dead. A faith that doesn't produce anything in you is mere assent. It's mere creedalism. But so you'll say, well, you have faith, I have deeds. Well, show me your faith without deeds. I will show you my faith by what I do. Christian faith is seen in the actions it produces in the life. You believe there's one God? Good, even the demons believe that and shudder. Or we could look at 1 John chapter 3, which says if you claim to love God that you can't see, but don't love your brother or sister who you can see, you're kidding yourself. How can you possibly say that you love God if you cannot love your brother or sister? And so Jesus is picking up on this great teaching and is challenging us. That requires more than simply a Facebook campaign, more than simply a diaconate poor committee in our church. We actually need a poor committee in our hearts. It needs to shape who we are. And so we begin by reflecting on the motivations for charity, the Christian motivations for charity. You see, we need to not just get principles and actions and structures and campaigns, but we need the motives right. If you're going to last this way and do it genuinely for lasting change in this broken world, you need to get your motives right. Not just outward deeds, but integrity. So your deeds match your heart. You don't want to be like Jermaine from, what was the name of the show again? The Summer Heights High, who was doing good deeds and was then offended by the gall of her sponsored child dying. How outrageous is this? This is so unfair. If I'm going to do good deeds, I want to at least for it to work out so I feel good about it. No, we've got to get our motives right. Not just so I feel good, because if I do it for that, I will collapse into disillusionment. We tried to stop Coney and we couldn't stop Coney, so I'm sick of stopping people. A bitterness or a disillusionment, I tried to help them and then they were mean back to me, so I'm not helping people anymore. A lethargy. We need a well to draw from, and that's the motives. And the first motive is that the path to life comes in doing good. The road to eternal life is the road to Jericho. If you want to live forever, you've got to love God with total love, and you've got to love your neighbour, especially your poor neighbour. Verse 37. Jesus said, go and do likewise. That's the good life. The good life is to go and do as the Good Samaritan did. That's the life of integrity. That's the spiritual life. That's the God-like life. We don't do good because we feel a bit guilty and bad about it, and so we feel we should do something. We don't do good so that people think we're nice and they go, oh, look at her, she's really nice. We don't do good so that we can get a good professional reputation. Not only do we deliver quality products, but we also contribute to the community in need. We don't just do good so that we can be a little bit more like Angelina or something. But we do good because it's right, because it is true, because it is the world we live in and is the heart of the God who made the world. It is the God-like way to live. Our God is a God of the poor, of the suffering, of the widow, of the fatherless. More, we do it because of the gospel. And it's the path to life. This is the life-giving way to live, but because of the gospel. You see, this is what Jesus is trying to do to this man in the story, right? If you put the Good Samaritan in context, it's more than just a story about doing good. It's a story that is showing the gospel to this guy. Jesus is talking to this expert of the law who is trying to narrow down what it means to live for God, you see. So this guy comes to Jesus and says, how do I go to heaven? How do I get eternal life? In verse 25. And Jesus says, well, have you read God's law? What does it say? And he says, yes, I have. It says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says, yes, that's right. That's the way to live. That's the path to life. But he goes, yeah, but I've got a question. Who is my neighbor? Now, don't think that he is the innocent asker who's going, look, I'm just not sure. I really want to ask my neighbor, but could you just tell me who my neighbor is? Because I don't know. Don't think that, right? Don't think innocent student who has maybe missed the first weeks of classes and stuck up their hand up the back of the class. No. You've got to think annoying mature age student down the front of the class who thinks they already know the answer and goes, "Teacher, I was just wondering, before I do, can I tell you about my son and my blah, 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 and then I was wondering, who is my neighbour?" It's a question he's figured out as a way of restricting his duties for charity. He tries to justify himself. See there, verse 29. He wanted to justify himself. And so he said, "Who is my neighbour?" And so Jesus tells this parable to expose that excuse, that justification. And to say the question is not narrowing down God's requirements by defining neighbour. Who is my neighbour? Is it just this side? You guys just need to do good to these people here, but not these guys over here? No, he flips it completely around and says, no. It's about, are you being a neighbour? Are you, even the person who is not the neighbour, who is in fact like a Samaritan, the undesirable, who is like the North Korean to the South Korean, even the person who is unlike you and who you don't want to be like, who is the Protestant Irish to the Catholic Irish, even the person who is not like you, be a neighbour to them. You see, if we could live the good life perfectly, if we could love God with all our heart and all our mind and all our soul and all our strength, if we could be a neighbour to everyone that we encounter, well then yes, go and do likewise, we'd live. But you don't, I don't, we don't. We don't live this way. None of us do. And we try and narrow down God's requirements so we can feel okay about ourselves and think we stand a chance, so that when we go to heaven we can go, "Well, look, God, I've done this and I've done this and I've done this and I've managed that and I tried here and I know I failed but I felt awfully bad about it. Can you please let me into heaven?" No. Jesus maximizes God's requirements to show us that no one is righteous, not even one. There's no one who fully does good. No one who seeks God fully. We've all turned away. We've all become worthless when it comes to eternal life. And he does this to drive this man and to drive us to the gospel. In 9 verse 51, he has begun his journey to Jerusalem to die and rise as the Saviour. And in chapter 18, he tells a great parable picking up on this word justify. Come across to Luke 18 and read a very important parable in Jesus' teaching about the true way. This is the way that the teacher of the law, we hope he reached this point, the true way to get justified. Luke 18. Luke 18 and verse 9. To some who are confident of their own righteousness, you know, trying to justify themselves, to some who are confident of their own righteousness and look down on everyone else, Jesus told this parable. Two men went into a temple to pray, one a Pharisee, one a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed, "God, I thank you that I am not like other men, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and I give a tenth of all I get," and we could add in there, "and also I love my neighbour," narrowly defined, see my mobile phone contract. But the tax collector, he's the one who gets it. He stands at a distance. He doesn't even dare look up to heaven. But he prays, "God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I don't love you with all my heart, with all my mind, with all my soul, with all my strength. I am not a neighbour to others." And Jesus says, you know the one who's justified actually? The repentant, the failure, the sinner, the one who says, "God, have mercy on me." God loved me with compassion and pity. He loved me in my self-made misery. He came to die for the likes of me. Christ, though he was rich, yet for our sake became poor, so that we, through his poverty, might become rich. And when I hit that kind of good news, and it really hits me in my mind, but in my heart, when that comes to live in my life, I learn what it means to be poor. Even if I'm rich and I've got the iPhone 4S and I've got a nice car that never breaks down and I live in a lovely house with my own bedroom and we've got three TVs in the house and we go away on holidays and we ski. And even if I have all of these things, I go, no, but in a sense I'm poor. Where it really counts, in the light, sight of God, in eternity, I'm poor, man. And I am only rich in Christ because of his mercy. We begin to see ourselves as poor in spirit, as Jesus said, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." And what a motivation, huh? What a motivation to do good, to care for others, to love as I've been loved. That's why my faith in God, who saves me once for all by his mercy, by my faith, bears fruit in works of compassion. Not out of guilt, not out of some sad anemic, sickly motive of mercy, not out of just to feel like I've got the full life, I've got good marks, I look great, and I do a little bit of good, and so I kind of feel sort of self-satisfied. No, no, no. But it's because I'm poor in spirit. God have mercy on me, a sinner. And the third motive given is compassion. Notice there in the story, verse 30 and following. 10 verse 30, back to Luke 10 verse 30. 10 verse 30, and the motive of compassion. Jesus said, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. He fell into the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and he went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So to a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, he passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he travelled, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. It's the same word used of Jesus' character, say in Luke 7 verse 13 or 15 verse 20. He had pity, he had compassion. He was moved in his guts at what he saw. Jesus had mercy on me, and so I do the same with the same compassion. Not because I believe people are objectively pure and good and we just need to somehow empower us all and then we'll, you know, be able to sort of jump around with bracelets together or something. If we think that, we will end up becoming betrayed by people, ripped off by people, disappointed that the poor people aren't as innocent as we thought they were, and outraged that they didn't do us a favour by thanking us more for our lovely charity. We'll become cynical and burned out. No, I do it because I've been touched by the gospel of God and it has moved my heart to compassion. Someone once asked me, how do I care for people in need without feeling used up and taken advantage of? Well, here's how. The way to do it is to be doing it to do good for them. Not so that you feel you're achieving something. Not so you feel like you can make a difference. But you're doing what you can for them because it is right and because you care for them. So disentangle your own self-interest and expectations from your desire to do good. That's the motive. Secondly, though, the sphere. Whom do I love? The lawyer says, who's my neighbour? And there is a strand through the Bible which echoes his mind. So I come back to, say, Deuteronomy 15. Deuteronomy 15. Whom do I love? We looked at the motive and now the sphere. Whom do I love? Deuteronomy 15. And here Jesus says, if a poor man among your brothers, that is your fellow Israelites, in the towns of the land the Lord your God is giving you, do not be hard-hearted or twice tight-fisted toward your brother. Or come across to John 15. John 15, now the other side of our main passage, John 15, and where Jesus speaks of greater love that no person can have. John 15. And verse 13, Jesus says, greater love has no one than this, that he lay down his life for his friends. Loving our friends, caring for our fellow Israelites. Or Galatians chapter 6, come across to Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. And verse 10. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all people, especially to those who belong to the family of believers. Do good to your fellow Israelites. Lay down your life for your friends. Do good especially to the family of believers. Or 1 Timothy 5, come along a little further to 1 Timothy 5. Do help each other if you're new to the Bible to navigate your way around as we get to 1 Timothy 5. And verse 4, if a widow has children or grandchildren, they should learn, first of all, 5 verse 4, they should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family and so repaying their parents and their grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. And verse 8, if anyone does not provide for his relatives and especially for his immediate family, he's denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. This is very, very important. And people in the church and people outside the church make this mistake. And you hear stories of children who've been raised in crusading families. who go, I feel like my parents cared a whole lot more about the lost on the other side of the world than they ever did for me. I feel like they cared a whole lot more for the starving in Africa than they ever did for me. It's a shameful thing for the good of some other cause to neglect those who have been entrusted to you. A shameful thing. Not least because it makes it very hard for the next generation to share your crusade. They hate your crusade. They see in the heart of your crusade a distorted ambition, an ambition-led charity. And they don't want anything to do with it. It's important to express your godliness in loving your friends, in loving your family, in loving your church, in loving your city, in loving your nation. Begin with the lonely grandparent and actually writing them, calling them, visiting them. Begin with your work around the house and serving your parents and noticing what they do for you. Begin with caring for the people in your classes, caring for the people in your church, caring for the people in... Begin there. And yet... Actually, can I just say one more thing on that? There's a certain kind of, particularly Western sort of guilt, where we feel that somehow our feelings should be totally objective, because, of course, the West is the defining measure of all things, right? And so we go, we as Westerners are so great and wonderful and terrific that we should be able to feel equal emotional compassion for everyone in the world. And sometimes preachers and speakers say this. They go, why do we care so much when we hear about an Australian dying, but we don't care when we hear about someone in another part of the world dying? Now, I know what they're trying to say. They're trying to arouse us to global concern and help us use our wealth to do good to the world. But there's something in there that's just unfair. No human being is able to care as much for someone that they don't have the emotional proximity to. We're not God. We're humans. And humans feel stronger emotional call and compassion to their friends, to their family, to their nation, to their circumstances. And you know what? That's the same with the poor people. It's the same with the disenfranchised people. That's the way we are. So yes, we should do good beyond our immediate family, but we need to realise that there are also emotional things that are natural and normal part of being human. That all being said, come back to Deuteronomy chapter 10. Deuteronomy chapter 10, again, we're going to jump back through the Bible and qualify things a little. Deuteronomy chapter 10. And verse 19. Oh, well, let's go from verse 17. The Lord your God, 10 verse 17, is God of gods and Lord of lords, the great God, the mighty and awesome, who shows no partiality and accepts no bribes. He defends the cause of the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the alien, not meaning ET, but meaning those from other nations. He loves the alien, the immigrant, the illegal immigrant, perhaps. He loves the alien, giving them food and clothing, and you are to love those who are aliens. For you yourselves were aliens in Egypt. Or Galatians 6, as we looked at before, yes, we are to especially show love to the household of believers, but we're to do good to all. To all. And of course, then Luke 10, that the Samaritan did good to the Jew, and we are to be like the one who is unlike us by liking others who are unlike us. The Jew is to be like, the teacher of the law is to be like the Samaritan, someone different to him. And the way he is to be like the Samaritan is to imitate the Samaritan's love for the Jew. To whomever. Not just love those who love you, not just love those you like and want to like you, not just love those who smell nice, not just love those who are funny or intelligent, not just love those people who actually say thank you to you and tell you how wonderful you are for the good you've done to them. Be a neighbour. Be the neighbour to others. It's a challenge, isn't it? But where do you stop? Well, one thing is to recognise God is at work in your circumstances. This Samaritan was happening along the way. In the first place, he wasn't undergoing a campaign to find people along every single road in all of the land of Judea. He was going along the road, and God put in his path someone in need. How is God at work in your circumstances of life and putting in your path those who are in need? It's a terrific experiment. I think it was in the God Delusion that it got talked about, where they did an experiment on doing good, where a bunch of seminary students in a theological college were told they were about to set an exam on the Good Samaritan. And there they were all getting ready. And then suddenly someone rushed into the room and said, "Actually, the exam's across the road. You need to go quick, 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 you're late. And so all these seminary students picked up their books and their pens, ready to write about the Good Samaritan, right across the road, right past someone who, a poor person who had just fallen over and injured himself on the road. And in this experiment, they all just ran right on past him because they were running late for their exam on the Good Samaritan. Ouch. The awkward moment when. You're not everyone, okay? You're not everywhere. I mean, we, in a sense, are because we can see everything, can't we, through the internet. But you are to be a neighbor, not God. You are to be a neighbor, not the mother of everybody, the father of everybody, the best friend of everybody, the neighbor. No, you shouldn't limit whom you love based on class or race or deservedness or ethnicity or sexual orientation or any of these things. No, you shouldn't limit whom you love, but you should take some lead from whom God puts in your path. Don't worry, in a sense, about solving all of the world's problems unless God happens to put you in the path of being hugely influential, in which case suddenly your path gets a whole lot wider. The shame of the priest in verse 31 and the Levite in verse 32, or the parable of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16, is stepping over the person in need and rushing off to your exam on the Good Samaritan. But the Samaritan recognizes God has placed him here for a reason, and he responds to that reason. So then, having looked at the motive we are to have, having looked at the sphere, the types of people we ought to love, let's thirdly look at the scope of charity, the scope of charity. Here in this passage, there are seven concrete things the Samaritan does. Now, I'm not saying that the parable of the Good Samaritan is teaching us these seven things. I'm just observing them in the passage. Okay, so it's not the primary purpose here, but still notice. Notice here that there, first of all, there's proximity in verse 34. He sees the need and he comes near. Verse 33, there's compassion, the emotional response. So there's proximity, there's drawing near, there's noticing a need, there's being attentive to need. There's emotional reaction, and there's being moved. Thirdly, there's medical attention, verse 34. The caring and tending to the wounds, medical care. Fourth, there's transport. That's a form of good deeds, especially if someone's lying in a dangerous strip of road and needs to be in some place where they can be looked after more. Transport. Fifth, shelter and providing for shelter. Sixth, nursing, the ongoing care of someone. And seventh, financial need, the giving of money to meet the needs into the future. Just in that little story. It's not what the passage is teaching. It's just incidental. But the very fact to tell the story, you need to list all of that makes a point, doesn't it? It's just in order to show how loving he was. Notice just how many things incidentally just have to be described. Love, you see, is more than just a little bit of money. Sometimes the money is the worst thing you could give. Love is more than just feeling sorry. It's holistic. And the best good deeds are always the more holistic. Short-term missions are great, and those of you who are in a Christian culture have maybe been on them and they've had a huge influence on your life. They're terrific. And so I do commend them to you as a thing that you can do to broaden your horizons about the world and God's work in it. To take a holiday that's not simply about taking photos of yourself in front of other religions' monuments and places where thousands of people got killed. But also to go and do something helpful while you travel. Terrific. Far better than going off and travelling for a year and kind of putting Christianity on pause while you just go and kind of work in the pubs of London or something. But we mustn't kid ourselves into thinking that a short-term mission actually does a great deal of good to the people you go to. It does a little bit of good. But mainly they are, as one missiologist described them, sanctification experiences in exotic locations. They are life transforming for the Christian who goes. More so, because ongoing need means you come back from the short-term mission and you become the generous supporter of missionaries who will be there for a lifetime. That's the ongoing good. Ongoing mission is coming back from the experience, then doing an MTS apprenticeship and going off to Bible college, then getting sent off so that you can minister in that place for a lifetime. Ongoing good is going to be praying steadily and consistently for holistic good. It's not just preach the gospel and send them off to die. It's not just feel sorry only or give advice only or give money only. But rather, God made us whole people in a whole world, and love involves all of that. You see, we could go beyond the Good Samaritan here and speak of other needs, spiritual needs. Give him a little tract after he's been dropped off at the inn. Give him a New Testament. Community needs. Contact other people in the village where he is and say this guy would appreciate some visit and some company. Advocacy needs. This poor old Samaritan, in order to find the people who killed him, he's going to need someone to kind of speak his case in the court. Environment needs, empowerment needs. See, charity is much more than simply giving $5. We are to love our neighbour as ourselves. We are to be neighbours, in fact, which requires a motive of knowing it is right, knowing Jesus loved us, and having his compassion. It means the sphere, beginning with friends and family and church, but overflowing to any in our path and beyond. And the scope, wherever possible, should be holistic to the whole person and ideally. Have you heard the saying before that you can give a person a fish, but far better to teach them how to fish? Are you willing to walk the Jericho Road? Well, yes, you would. Except I've just got a couple more questions, actually. Just a couple more questions. There might be some questions or excuses that you have, and I want to address those in the time remaining. I've got three, I think. So let's just cover those quickly. The first is, what if I can't? I'm too busy. I'm struggling. I'm stretched. I can't do everything. I can't run all the live-in shelters, serve in all the soup kitchens. I just can't manage. The first thing is to just get the motive right, to realise this is part of your Christian faith, is to show practical good to others. If you don't feel it, and if you don't feel it, then you're not really doing it. There's got to be some degree of cost, you see, some degree of sacrificial care, that if it doesn't hurt at all, if it comes at no cost to myself, if I do good as convenient, then that's not really following the one who came to die for us, is it? So I've got to begin there and begin to go, well, it should change me somehow so that I feel it. I may be time poor, but I may have some money. And so I should change my budget and adjust my budget so I can give. I may be money poor, but be time rich, and so I can give some time and figure out what that is. I need to find a way to budget my life, to have time emotionally, financially, chronologically, to be available as some expression of my service of Christ. Because to love like this is to give up individualistic control, as if somehow, basically my life is mine, and I give God a little bit, and then he catches that, and then he kind of, you know, kicks the goals for me. But it's actually that, no, my time is his. All my time is his. And I want to give my life to others. To take responsibility, not to be free to do what I want, but to care for others. How do you choose, you might ask? Do I give to every beggar? Do I befriend every needy person? Where does it ever end? What if they call me on the one day I've got to sleep in? Do I have to go and help them? Well, you must be careful that your worry about doing everything doesn't become an excuse to do nothing. That's easy, isn't it? Well, I can't fix everything. So what I've decided I'll do, the best thing I can do since I can't fix everything, is I'll do absolutely nothing. Something's gone a little wrong there, hasn't it? Instead, be proactive rather than reactive. Bless you. The reason we feel guilty is that we don't do anything. And we still start to feel defensive and guilty. But if we go, no, I know what I do. I've decided what I can do. And I resolve to do that. And so I know that when I say no, I'm not saying no to everything, but I'm doing what I can. Find the good organizations to support. Establish certain values in your lifestyle and then act. You see, the key to overcoming this objection is to be proactive and to recognize God is sovereign. He's given you certain gifts, certain capacity, certain circumstances, certain relationships. And so serve him with those. Second objection, the moral ideal objection. I would love to do good, but I don't want to get ripped off ever. I want to only do it to the people who need it, who deserve it. I don't want to give good to people who will waste it. Yeah, like God with you, right? You know, you'll just forgive the people who deserve to be forgiven. No. The gospel came to the ill-deserving, to those who didn't deserve it. The gospel is a second chance. It's the people who wasted their lives and who are the risky prospects who might waste again. No, so gospel life is undeserving. And it's compassionate to those who don't deserve our trust or compassion. Maybe we don't want to make a mistake with who we care for because we want to save face. It would be embarrassing if we tried to help someone and then later on we got told, oh yeah, that guy goes around to all the churches. He's a scam artist. And then we feel ashamed. We don't want to feel used. You will. You will feel used. That's part of the cost of loving wicked, sinful people. Part of the cost of loving needy people is realizing needy people are selfish too, self-absorbed too, manipulative too. And so part of the cost of caring for people is running the risk of being abused and being embarrassed. But we need to be savvy, nevertheless. And here are some things that you can bear in mind to be thoughtful, not just for your own reputation, but for the good of the person. First, give gifts in kind, as in stuff rather than money. Pretty wasteful to give money if someone's going to stick it in a poker machine or drink it after his visit to the 9/11. So buy the food rather than give the money. Second, as you establish relationship with the person, increase accountability. So yeah, undeserved giving to the person who comes to you, but as a pattern is established, a relationship is established, and part of relationship, which is good for you and for them in terms of respect, is accountability. Well, yeah, I'll give you some more again, but before I do that, I really would like to sit down and talk about some budgeting with you. Look, I'll help you out this time, but look, I can't always be on call in the middle of the night. We really need to go and see a counsellor with you at some stage. I can't just be the one who's there after the fact. You need to get some help. Sometimes you need to put your foot down now rather than enable a person to continue in a self-destructive path. Does that make sense? And sometimes saying no and closing the door now means you can open the door 3 months later and they can say, I know, you were right, and now I'm ready to actually have you help me do good long term. That's hard, isn't it? But sometimes you need to learn how to say no for love to the other person. And so then the third principle is gifts in kind, accountability over time, and holistic care. Don't just give money, don't just give lifts, don't just give counselling support. You want to get the person coming to church or seeing a counsellor or going to Colony 47 or getting fit. You know, these sorts of things that will help someone holistically. And last of all, aren't we meant to be about saving people from hell? There's only so much we can do. Time is short. All our time and money should be devoted towards doing eternal good through the preaching of the gospel. After all, did not Jesus himself? Well, in this passage a bit later on there, we've got Luke 10. Jesus says to Mary and Martha, 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 you're worrying about many things, doing the dishes and stuff. Only one thing is needed. Mary is doing what is needed. It won't be taken away from her. Luke 10, 41 and 42. Didn't Jesus say, I've come to preach? That's why I've come. And he even turned away from people coming for healing so that he could preach the gospel. Yeah, yeah, that's right. And yet Jesus did also heal. And sometimes even his preaching was interrupted so that he could heal. He did care for those in need. You see, the world we live in is not black and white. It's complicated. God made it that way. It's his fault. Complex doesn't mean fallen. Yeah? Sometimes it is a time, like Ecclesiastes says, there's a time to sow and there's a time to gather. There's a time to do good. There's a time to preach the gospel. You've got to know the time. There's a time just to sleep. There's a time to veg out. There's a time to stay up late. You see, recognizing that the gospel is more important because it helps people, it's charity for eternity, that doesn't mean, therefore, you must neglect it. In fact, this very passage pairs the preaching mission in chapter 10, verses 1 to 24, with the parable of the Good Samaritan. Both messengers and neighbours, you see. We are to be both preachers and carers. We have the mission of evangelism. That is the mission of God's people now. That is the ultimate outcome, the priority, the focus. The agenda is the proclamation of the message of salvation. That's what we're about. But we have the duty of love. You see, the Great Commission and the Great Commandment, the mission is the proclamation of the gospel, the salvation of people from hell, the charity for eternity. But the mode is loving lives, loving others. See, the gospel mission is not good deeds. The kingdom doesn't come through justice and compassion. It comes through preaching and prayer. But love is the motive for our preaching. We want to do good by sharing them the message of salvation.